usually speak about somebody whose yard site is going to be in the coming month. And the person who I would like to speak about today was Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel. His yard site is Chaf Tes Tishrei. We're not going to have another market till then, so now's the time to speak about it. First of all, I usually like to say where I get my information from, because, I mean, how do we know something about somebody who lived, you know, 500-600 years ago? So stories that people write, there's no end to stories you can write. So we have, in the Abarbanel, we're fortunate, we have his own stories in his Sfarim, in his Hakdomis. Because of what he went through, a lot of what he went through, he recorded it. He wrote Shvachas HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He pours out his tzaris. So in his Hakdomis to a lot of his Sfarim, he talks about things that happened to him and the basic outline of his life is in those Hakdomis. They're not that easy to read. They're kind of poetic. So, and he doesn't spell out everything 100%, and it's a rich Hebrew, but tachlis, the information, the basic information about his life is there. A person who wrote what's considered to be a definitive work is somebody called Benzion Netanyahu, whose son is more famous as Bibi Netanyahu. He was a professor of different Semitic languages and history and things like that. He specialized in the Spanish era, and he put out a book, it's in English. It was put out three times. Half of it is a biography, half of it is a discussion of his different approaches and so on. Like all the historians, and I think more so, there's the facts, the sources that he brings, that he has some primary sources, documents of Spanish documents. He has interpretation of it, and then he has his own take on everything, which, again, you can separate out and leave it. I mean, his own take is very political. He has his own approach to things. It's not something that we would consider. But Al Kapanim, as far as the basic facts goes and what's reliable, what's not, that's a very good source for it in English, and he sticks to the basic information. He was one of those people who lived in the most extraordinary Tkufa and Kali Yisrael's times, Ger Sfarad. He was arguably one of two possibly big figures who were in that time. And his life carries an extraordinary marks of the time. He was born in 1437 in Lisbon, Portugal. They claimed a yichus from David HaMelech. They had yichus going back a few dairies, and it was considered to be a family that comes from David HaMelech. They were an extraordinarily prominent family. His father was one of the most connected, wealthy families in Portugal, Spain, in the Iberian Peninsula. He was extremely wealthy, his father, and some sort of high rank by the king. And the Abarbanel himself would become an extraordinarily wealthy man and extraordinarily well-connected. That was where he got started from. His grandfather, Reb Shmuel Abarbanel, it's quite clear that lo aleinu he had shmat. It wasn't clear under the duress what happened exactly, but he was one of those who converted to Christianity, and when he escaped from Spain to Portugal, dropped it. And I want to say some background information, which I think is important. The Spanish Golos was an unusual Golos, in that Spain was a very developed country. It was nice, it was wealthy, it had rich cultural trappings to it. The Jews were extremely interwoven in the society, and they competed with the Spanish in wealth, in they partook in a culture. There was an extreme acculturation of the Jews over there in Spain. There were people that that became converted, that converted to Christianity because they actually fell for it. Small, very small amount, but that happened. There were people who recognized that they couldn't really make that final move to have what they wanted without converting. They converted. There were people that were forced to convert. There was all sorts of pressures. A king would catch you and whatever it is, and there would be a lot of pressure on you to convert, on the threat of death, on the threat of taking away your family, and so on. In 1391, I think almost 50% of Spanish Jewry converted. There were pogroms and stuff like that. It was very rough times, very terrible times, and it was a lot more complicated. The history that we give over is just everyone's heroes and they Kiddush Hashem. There were many that went on Kiddush Hashem, but unfortunately many not. We don't know exactly what, but his grandfather seemed to have been, and his grandfather shook it off and escaped. So obviously must have been under some sort of duress and so on. So he himself was born in Lisbon in 1437, I believe it was, and he was born to wealth, to power, and so on. We don't know much about his early years. We know he'd learned in the yeshiva of Maria Buov, not the first one, but the second one. His first book that he wrote was a purely secular type of book. It dealt with the Sodos, the Tsuros. It was something which had zero shaykhs, no psukim, no chazal, nothing. It was a learned work on what was considered science in those days. That was his early years, as much as we know. He grew up in Lisbon. The king's name was Alfonso. He had a very good relationship with the Jews. And most of the time, these good relationships were there because they needed the Jews. And he got along well. The first thing we have recorded of him as a leadership position was the King Alfonso conquered parts of Morocco. He took many people captive, sold them as slaves. Amongst them were 250 Jews. The Barbanel, the one we're talking about, Danitska Barbanel, took a tremendous leadership role, and he organized a campaign across Spain to raise money to redeem these Jews. I mean, if he didn't redeem these Jews, they would be sold as slaves anywhere. And he redeemed them, helped them resettle, helped them get on their feet, and so on. It took a tremendous amount of money, obviously, because people knew that Jews would redeem slaves. He had to negotiate with many, many different captors, and it took a lot of negotiating skill. It took a lot of effort, a lot of money, and he organized. I don't know if it was a matching campaign, but it was something he organized in the entire Iberian island, a campaign to raise money and to redeem these people and settle them. That's the first record we have of him taking on a leadership role commensurate with his standing, with what he was and who he was. Like I said before, King Alfonso was extremely friendly with the Barbanel family, and they had a great relationship. Now, Barbanel was an extraordinarily wealthy man and well connected. The king died in 1481, and the next king that took over, his name was Joao the Second, and he was extremely paranoid about the relationship of the strong and wealthy landowners. I want to explain two things about the history of these places for a long time that we have a hard time understanding. First thing is, we think of a country today, Spain. A size of Spain was really quite impossible to govern. You're talking about a huge country. It's not huge when you have a car and a telephone and an airport. But when you're doing it by horseback, it's incredibly big. And there were no countries, viable countries, those sizes. So Spain was divided into a dozen different countries, county, duchies and counties and all sorts of things. But there were smaller units, like the size of a state, of a province, was much more manageable. So those were real units. In European history also, provinces were units that were stable because they made sense, they were geographically made sense, and they were small enough to run, using the primitive ways of communication. Countries were the beginning of empires, and they usually lasted for a small time, someone conquered it, and so on. It's true of Spain, it's true of Italy, it's true of everywhere. All these places that today we think of as countries, really, so Spain had many, many sub-countries, which were countries. Secondly, there was always a tension between the king and the people who owned the castles and the fiefdoms. Who is the boss? Is the king the boss and they're servants of his, or are they the rulers and he's a figurehead for the country? So there was always a tension between the two. This king became king. And either it was true or he was paranoid about it. He decided that the nobles are plotting against him, and therefore he tricked them and had them killed. He also thought Abarbanel, Rabiska Abarbanel, is involved in plotting against him, and he invited him for a meeting to the castle. Somebody met Abarbanel right before he's going there and told him, the meeting is there to kill you. It's a trap to kill you. He agonized and he decided they're right. He ran away that night from Portugal to Spain. To Spain meaning, one of the Spanish places. He was very shrewd because he knew they'd be watching and looking for him. So he did a very circuitous route. He ran away, leaving his family behind, wife and kids, and all his money. The king was very upset. The king either had confirmed his fears or whatever. And Abarbanel wrote a very strong letter protesting his innocence and not to no avail. Lemaisa, they confiscated everything he owned. In those days, money was very not portable. You had fields, you had houses, you couldn't, once you left the country, they were gone. Even money, there's a limit to how many gold coins you can put on your pocket when you're running away. So basically, he went overnight from a very wealthy, established chasheva personality to being a homeless pauper. He ran away to Spain. He managed to get his wife and kids there and resettled pretty much a poor person. This is where he wrote his first Sefer. And he had written before, it started writing for him before, but he sat and he wrote a Hakdama that it was Mizboinen, why it is that all this befell him. And he writes, this is an Hakdama to Yeshua. And he says, he came to the realization it's because he was so concerned about his material well-being and not about his ruchnius and his ruchnistic emission. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch had punished him. And he sat, and in 4.5 months, he wrote the Abarbanel and Yeshua Shoeftim and Shmuel. He finished it. It's quite a large amount. If you look at Abarbanel, does not spare words. It's a huge amount of work in 4.5 months. And he finished it. The king of Spain, this is, you're talking about the 1483, was our beloved Ferdinand and Isabella. Those who know them from Columbus, or those who know them from Gerir Sfarad, they were the king. They were busy fighting a war with Granada, which was a Moorish kingdom in Spain. The Moors were an African Muslim tribe. Bechlal, Spain had over the years fights between the Muslims and the Christians, and Lamaisa, the Christians had basically cleared out the Iberian Peninsula, and Granada was the last Moorish stronghold, and it was involved in a very tough war. Wars cost money, and he was out of money, Ferdinand, and he'd heard that the Abarbanel really had a lot of financial smarts, and he called him for a meeting, him and the queen. They made him in charge of getting the finances, finding money, borrowing money, rearranging, restructuring stuff, and he was there for them for the next 8 years or so. He became a treasurer, and he became the one who basically found the money for it, until he defeated, a few years later, he defeated the Moors, drove them out. Now that the Muslims were gone from the peninsula, so the next people were the Jews. And he basically decreed that the Jews would leave Spain. The Abarbanel writes about this. He said he came to plead to him. 3 times he came to plead to him. And he told him it's the queen's fault. She's the one who's behind it. He spoke to her. He got no traction. The Galach was involved also. It's very unclear who was manipulating who, or if everybody was together. It could be that the real force was the Galach, and they were like under his spell. There is other shitas that they were just getting rid of the Jews, and the Galach was very convenient. They were both of them. The king wanted the money, and there was also a lot of the people wanted the Jews out because the Jews were taking the jobs of the middle class and so on. Be it as it may, they were resolute that they're throwing the Jews out. The Abarbanel offered money, and he offered a huge amount of money. And the king actually flinched, and like, maybe it's worth it. There's a story, and this is not documented, but it's a story that that went around a lot, so, and it makes sense, that when he began wavering because of the amount of money that they was offered, the Galach was there, and he threw the cross on the ground, and he said to King, "You're going to be the second Judas that will have sold out our Lord for money." And that was already, that was too difficult for him to swallow, and that forced his mind. I don't know, I bet some have a Shiloh of why money would at all affect the king, because at the end they threw the Jews out and took the money anyway. So they got the best of all worlds. They didn't need the Jews there with the money unless they thought ahead, and they didn't realize that they're killing the goose that's laying the golden egg, which is what happened. But right now, by throwing the Jews out penniless, which what they did, there was everything would be for them. Al Kapanim, he told Abarbanel, he pleaded Abarbanel to convert, because he liked Abarbanel a lot, he wanted him there. There was another Rav who was called like the Zkan Rabbanim, somebody named Rav Sanyor, who was 80, he actually converted. But most of the vast majority of Jews at that time did not. And in 1492, 300,000 Jews, which was the remnants of the Jews in Spain, with the Abarbanel left. I want to explain what it meant. Leaving the Golos of Sfarad was it wasn't just moving from America to Canada. A, there was no place to go. France had thrown out the Jews, England had thrown out the Jews, Germany was a horrible place. There were no places. Two, wherever they went, if they went more than a few people, the country, if they could find a country that wanted them, didn't want to have many Jews. The anti-Semitism everywhere. There was no work, no jobs. Jews had businesses, connections. They were coming to a place. Imagine somebody takes you and parachutes you into Mozambique, and you're stuck there for the rest of your life. What do you do? You don't know the language. You don't know what to do. You have nothing. That was the situation that they were being thrust in. They couldn't take along any money. The voyage on the ships was horrible. The captain of the ships took advantage of them. They ended up, some of them, on islands, dying of thirst. It was a horrible, horrible. It wasn't going to a different country and relocating. It was basically being thrown off the cliff and hoping that they find a soft spot where something cushions their blow. That was it. In the big picture, many went to Turkey, some went to Amsterdam. The Abarbanel chose to go to Italy, and again, Italy was also not a country in those days. There were many little, most countries in Italy, most provinces did not let Jews in. Naples was involved in wars with other ones, and they took in Jews. Same svara, same reason. And the Abarbanel ended up over there in Naples. And he began writing. Now, he wrote Sfarim about Geula, about Mashiach. I think he felt it was a Tzorech HaShoah. He was mechazik the Jews because they were really broken. The Christians told them, your people are despised by your God. See what's happened to you. You see we're right, that God is sick and tired of Israel, and therefore we're the true religion and you should convert. And that was the matzah. This was the bulk of Klal Yisrael, and they were being thrown out to the dogs. He was very mechazik them, and he wrote sfarim, a bunch of sfarim on different topics, Mashiach, the Geula, the Zman, and the Geula, and so on. And he became again. So this is the third time round. He became successful, wealthy, and he became a treasurer of the King of Naples. The King of France was fighting, and he conquered Naples, and the Abarbanel had to run again. And again, run, leave everything behind, and he wandered a bit to Corfu, Sicily. The last years he ended up in Venice, which he was able to live in. When he died, Jews were not allowed to be buried in Venice, and they buried him in Padua. That was the course that he took. In that second half of his life, he wrote his Sfarim on Chumash. He wrote, finished on Tanakh, on Navi, on Neviim with Daniel. He wrote the Sfarim on Mashiach. It's three sfarim that deal with Geula. Then he wrote Sefer on Hashgacha. He wrote a Sefer Sfarim on the Rambam, on part of Mor Nevuchim. He wrote a Pirish on Pirkei Avos. He wrote a Pirish on the Haggadah of Pesach, and so on. An incredible volume of written material for somebody who had gone through what he went through and wasn't sitting in one place at one time. It's what we have of him in Sfarim is an incredible Yerusha. First of all, he actually happened to be mentioned in halacha, and people don't know it, but the Beis Yosef brings him down at least once. The Chiddush says he brings him a few times. I found once, a computer check, once in Hilchis Brachis, he speaks about, you know, when something is Mezoinis, Tamaitzi, and he quotes the Barbanel, and so on. The Ramon, the Akim Moshe, brings him in Hilchis Talmud Torah, and here and there he's quoted in Halacha. So obviously he was a Talmud Chacham. If the Beis Yosef is quoting him as a mocker for Halacha, he was obviously considered, Beis Yosef was a contemporary. He was much younger, but he overlapped. So they obviously considered each other, and he considered him to be a posek worthy of quoting. His Sfarim on Navi became in many ways, the Malbim writes, that he used Abarbanel as his basis for a lot of what he wrote. Abarbanel and Sfarim will give some of the tchunis. First of all, he's encyclopedic. He brings what everyone else had written, and he argues with it many times, but he brings down everything before him. There are tainus that sometimes he quoted people without mentioning name, but by and large, he brings everything that was before him, Baruch, he brings on Inyan. His style in Nevi'im is, he has like, and in Chumash, and he writes, he starts off with a huge amount of questions, and then he says he sowed, and he retitles the psukim and reteaches everything, and so on and so forth. He has it in for the Spanish that were drawn in by philosophy. In other words, he did not go with the kav of the earliest ones who basically philosophized the Teichen of Tanakh. He was not for that. He writes that he doesn't know Kabbalah, but Kabbalah is the Chochmas Emes. He quotes the Zohar a bunch of times. He alludes to Kabbalah. It definitely comes across that Kabbalah is the right way to go, and there's enough there that it's clear that he had some degree of familiarity, if not more. He does. He has some interesting things that are unusual. He quotes Christian sources, and sometimes he goes to argue with them. The big issue was, did Mashiach come or not? What is these Nevuahs referring to? And so on. And he obviously makes it his business to take apart the Christian arguments and to basically demolish them. But every so often, he will quote a Christian source and say he feels that he has the right pshat and use it. It's a highly unusual thing, especially for somebody who's being persecuted by Christians. He still would use the Pirush if he felt it was a right. He also, Chazal on Inyanim of Agadata, he treats in a way where you could argue with them and say pshat differently, which wasn't uncommon in the earliest form, but after that it stopped becoming acceptable. But so he would do that. He holds the Rambam in high esteem, except, you know, he argues on some points. He has a sefer Rosh Hashanah on the Yud Gimel Ikrim of the Rambam and defends the Rambam against those who hold as a different number of Ikrim and who will argue with the Rambam. He's a stout defender of it. There are places where he defends the Rambam but doesn't hold like the Rambam. And he writes someplace the following quip. This is the opinion of Rabbeinu Moshe, but not of Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, you know, I'm saying pshat in the Rambam, and he deferred, he's in Mechaber the Rambam tremendously, but he holds in certain places, he's not right. But Al Kaponim, in general, he does. Those are some interesting nekudas about the Sfarim of his. He basically sealed a tkufa He is the Gadol that went that into exile with the Spanish Jews. He was the leading figure. He writes a lot of times expressing why he feels HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought it on them. He feels that they had become too materialistic, too enamored with philosophy. He writes his criticisms here and there. He also is very mechazik people, that all of this is a preparation for the Geula, that the Geula is Karav Liyos, Emunah and Mashiach, and so on. Himself, there's another tragedy he suffered in this process. His son writes in a kinah of piyut something to the effect of having his own child stolen by the goyim, kidnapped, baptized. They wouldn't give him back because it's a piyut form. It's not 100% clear where the circumstances were, but it's clear that happened. There are stories that at the end they were able to smuggle him out again when he was a grown up. I don't know. You know, the first part is certainly expressed in the kinah, but more than that is not, it's not clear. Like upon him, his life was an extraordinary life in a very turbulent times. The fact that a person was able to be such an accomplished businessman, such an incredible leader, and a Talmud Chacham of note, I mean, the fact that the Beis Yosef quotes him l'alacha, the Dr. Moshe quotes l'alacha, the fact that he wrote the huge amount that he wrote, and his Sfarim are, in Navi especially, are foundational. This is, you know, the Malbim said, this is what he used as his base. It's an incredible accomplishment, and it's for somebody to have to start over 3-4 times. Can you imagine somebody losing everything he possesses, being thrown out homeless, and deciding that the reason why it's like why this has happened to me is because I haven't devoted my time to Talmud Torah. It happened another time to him, and another time. Thrown out of Portugal, thrown out of Spain, thrown out of Naples, wandered back and forth. I'm not sure what the story was with Sicily, with Corfu. But Al Kapanim did not have a settled life, an easy life, and yet produced so much, which is Lederis. This was it. He, in many ways, in his Sfarim, encapsulated Tkufa Sfarad, the extraordinary diuk on Mikra, the philosophy, and then the pushback against philosophy, the acceptance, the emergence of Kabbalah. All that is reflected in the Sfarim, and you see it that way. Upon him, his yahrzeit is Choftes Tishrei, and it's an extraordinary life in extraordinary times. Most people speak about the heroics of the Anusim song, but to understand the tragedy of it, I mean, how many Jews Shmat we don't talk about? It's a very, very sad parsha. The terrible, terrible, I mean, being exiled from Spain was akin to being in a spaceship and told to leave. There was no place to go. It basically, people going to death by sea, death by starvation, death by animals, death by robbers. That's what they were going to. And he stood there and was mechazik, held their hands, and basically transitioned the new door that rose afterwards. Okay.